Okay, I think we fixed the problem. Thanks for reporting that to me in the chat program. You can always join us over on Real Liberty Media in the chat room. And you can join in the conversation. What's better than that? Everything. No, nothing. I'm kidding. It's all good. Thanks anyway, you guys. And thanks for joining me on a Wednesday evening. I'm going to try and make this a normal show. That'd be awesome. Fun for me. Hopefully you guys enjoy it. Now, today is a no COVID show. It should be interesting to see how much silent time there is. I'm kidding. I don't think there will be any. Because I kind of wanted to talk about a couple things that are a little more personal. Just a little history of my life. Because I really think my life has been, I would say blessed. I don't want to offend anybody. I've had like this amazing life. Like kind of a Forrest Gump kind of life. And that's, I'm not kidding about that, like one bit. I've done some stuff in my life that if I didn't do it, I wouldn't believe it. I think one thing I could just allude to a little bit, this is back when I was actually in the service. I was in the Coast Guard. No, I was actually in college. I had stayed in the Coast Guard Reserves. And man, I really hate, I'll just tell you. So when I was in the Coast Guard active duty, I studied hard. I was an electrician. I wanted to get more pay, and the only way you got more pay is by getting promoted. And the way you got promoted was by studying your skill, taking tests, and, you know, getting on the list to get promoted. Well, I did that very quickly. In my 4 years of active duty, I became a first-class petty officer as an electrician. And actually, you know, probably because I was good at math and I am a critical thinker and whatever, I did really well. Electricity made sense to me, you know, and I was good at it. So I got promoted. Well, then when I went into college, I went to the University of Oregon. I got a degree in biology, a Bachelor of Arts in Biology, which basically means I also took 2 years of a foreign language. I mean, the difference between a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts is that you have like 2 years of stuff, something. In my case, it was 2 years of a foreign language. But while I was going to college, I stayed in the Coast Guard Reserves because I wanted to have some income, and that was kind of the easiest way to get a little bit of income. I had the old GI Bill, so they were paying for all of my college anyway. I mean, they don't pay for your college. They pay you a certain amount of money every month while you're going to college. This was the old days. Now, you know, if you go into service, you have to pay into, I don't know, that college fund or education fund or whatever. Anyway, they don't give it to you. It's you kind of pay into it, I guess. But before this system, if you enlisted in the service and you did 4 years, I think maybe less, but 4 years, they would actually pay you while you were in college, you know, the old GI Bill. And then on top of that, I would do 1 week in a month in the Coast Guard Reserves, and I got, I don't know, a few $100 for that too. It seems to me at the time, it about made a car payment, which was pretty cool. But in the summer times, if I wasn't going to go to school in the summertime, which, you know, like for maybe kids straight out of college who aren't used to going to school in the summertime, maybe they take summers off. I was an adult. I had been in the service for 4 years, so I didn't even start college until I was 22 or 23. And I wasn't really interested in taking summers off necessarily. I was interested in getting done with this educational program so I could move on with my life, whatever it was I was going to do. I mean, originally, I kind of figured, I would become a dentist. But just in case, my fallback was to have a degree in biology and either go into marine biology or animal behavior or something like that. But so while one summer, the Coast Guard asked me, I guess they ask you when you're a reserve, they said, hey, we're working on this, we want to complete this project, and we're selecting a handful of people to work on this project, and you know, you would be active duty for 90 days of the summer, which was really cool, because then I got like 3 months of real pay, and I would work for 90 days, like Monday through Friday, you know, and go home on the weekend and stuff, except I didn't really get to go home on the weekend because this certain, I'm telling you, if I hadn't have done this, I wouldn't believe it. So if you don't believe it, that's fine. I don't care. I'm just telling you stories today. So the project was we were making an electronic cabinet that would scramble radio signals and de-scramble radio signals, and it also tracked different vessels. And before I, well, I'll just tell you why. It was created to stop, you know, drugs from coming into this country. It was created to track drug runners out on the high seas. But what was kind of funny, like all of us who were in the Coast Guard, like, you know, the Coast Guard, it's a cool job, but it's just a job, really. It's just another job. I mean, the life-saving stuff was pretty cool. The law enforcement stuff, I always thought was kind of BS. I mean, you know, you're out there on fisheries patrols, making sure nobody's breaking the rules while they're fishing. Like, those guys need any more hassle while they're out there fishing. But, you know, like, you would stop them and board them and make sure that they had the right number of life jackets and fire extinguishers were working and the engine room had a sprinkler system or a fire suppression, just stuff, you know. More government interference into trying to make a living, in my opinion. And the other thing was, like, pretty much everybody in the Coast Guard, that's not true. Some people actually thought they were making a difference. Like, I think some of the officers who were in command and, you know, the higher-ups, I think they really believed that they were making a difference. But the rest of us were like, I don't care how many tons of cocaine you show on the news. I don't care how many bales of pot you show on the news. It's a minutia compared to what's coming into this country from every which way. And that was back in the late 70s. I mean, I went in the Coast Guard in 76. So even way back then, we knew we weren't doing that good a job. But the cool thing is that I thought this job we were doing that summer was pretty cool. I got to work with so I was an electrician. Basically, electricians in the Coast Guard are kind of basically we worked on power supply, power generation and supply, right? And all the gadgets that, you know, are plugged in the wall, except you had electronics technicians who were in charge of electronic stuff like radar, radios, computers, tracking systems, you know, the air support stuff, you know, ground to air radios, all that stuff, and, you know, and basically electronics, computers and stuff. So they had like one of the top electronics technicians in the Coast Guard, also a reserve guy. He was there, and I was there. We were the two top guys, and then we had about four to six other guys work during the 90 days that he and I were there. But the crazy thing was, like, this was another one of those kind of Area 51 sort of setups. Like, nobody knew where we were working. Nobody had access to where we were working. It was really secure. We had to have clearance, not top secret, but we had to have clearance to work on it. And so the other four people, I think, that worked with us, they worked in shifts. Like, they would come for 2 weeks and then go. And there was some parts that the other chief and I had to work on that we had to work on alone. And once we were done, and it would be sealed up, and then, you know, nobody else could work on it. But anyway, so that was kind of a cool project. You know, here I was in college. I was, you know, doing okay in college, of course, or I wouldn't have got into dental school. Although, well, that's another story I'm going to tell you today. And, you know, and I got paired up with this guy to work on just the fact that I had the opportunity to work on this piece of equipment was just kind of crazy. It kind of goes in that, to me, it kind of goes in that bag of stuff is like, what? So you couldn't find anybody else, so I got picked, you know, and then it turns out to be a really awesome program. Now, maybe they picked me because of my skills. I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't know. You know, I mean, I could, yeah, try and toot my horn and go, yeah, I was, you know, the best one for the job. I have no idea, honestly. But it was pretty amazing that I got selected to work on that piece of equipment and technology at the time. I mean, it was, so that was in the early 80s. Because I was active duty from 76 to 80, and then I was in the reserves from 80 to 89, basically. And, you know, technology was just coming along, you know, electronics and computers and, you know, microchips. I mean, we were just getting to the point where we could start putting huge amounts of gadgets in a small space to do really high-tech stuff. And so that was pretty cool, you know, just, it was just crazy. And actually, even the fact that, so when I went in the Coast Guard, I don't, you probably, some of you do know how boot camp works and some people don't. So you go to boot camp, mostly it's just like physical training, and of course you have some didactic training, so you learn about the Coast Guard, and you learn how to tie knots, and you learn how to fire all the different weapons, and, you know, you learn self-defense and offense and stuff. And one of the things that they kind of walk you through is all of the different jobs that are available in the service, you know, whatever service you're in. And my scores to get in the service, I forget what that test is called. I think it's ASFAB, but I could be wrong. But anyway, I had really high scores, so I could do basically anything, any job I wanted to do. So I don't know if I was greedy at the time or just a young person looking to, you know, have success fast and get out, but they were going over all these ratings, and they were like, yeah, and electricians, we, you know, we're in desperate need of electricians. And, you know, it was a critical rating. In other words, they lose electricians faster than they produce them. So, and so what they basically were saying, if you become an electrician, the rate is so critical that you can make rank pretty quickly, like right on time, whenever you're available to make rank. You can make rank if you're great, if your scores are good, if you stay out of trouble and you do the time, you can get promoted. So I was like, oh, I'll be an electrician. And kind of part of my decision about becoming an electrician was like this. You know, I don't know anything about electricity, nothing. I was 19 years old. I didn't have the fog. I mean, I knew you needed like a battery to start your car. I knew that you needed, you know, a light socket to plug in a lamp and TV and radio and stuff like that. But I had no idea where it came from, how it was produced, you know, nothing. I knew nothing. And so being, you know, the kind of guy I am, I was like, you know, that'd be kind of cool, become an electrician and learn about electricity. Well, there you go. So I decided to become an electrician because, number one, I had learned something, and number two, it was a critical rating so I could get promoted quicker and make more money sooner. And, of course, that was probably my goal at the time, you know, having just left home. So yeah, I became an electrician. Oh, I went in the Coast Guard. I was up in Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, actually Auk Bay, which is outside of Juneau, about, I don't know, 20 miles. And I was on a small boat, a motor lifeboat. That was kind of fun. And it was also really crazy because the guys that I was on the motor lifeboat with liked to drink a lot while we were underway, which was kind of crazy. But I would not say that's unusual. I mean, hell, we usually only manned the motor lifeboat with six people, you know, and usually it was ones driving the boat that were pretty hammered. So it was interesting, let's just say. It was interesting. And in Alaska, man, that was crazy because of everything. I mean, it's Alaska, although it's not like way north Alaska. Like I remember thinking, oh, we're going to have nights that are, you know, that are 24 hours long. Not so true. They were about 20 hours long. Between 18 and 20 hours long, we got between 4 and 6 hours of light in the middle of winter. Something like that. I just know it seemed like it got light about 10 o'clock and it got dark about 2, something like that. So it was pretty damn dark the rest of the time in the winter. But also like the northern lights and these glaciers and these giant mountains and all this freaking wildlife. Like in Auk Bay especially, you could literally watch the cycle of life happen like in the springtime. You would see, like, I remember standing out on the dock, like, you know, you're always doing maintenance in the service. You're always either painting or scraping paint off, you know, or, you know, you're always changing parts out on the engine, oil change, you know, I don't know, reduction gears, prop serve, all that stuff has to be done. So, you know, we were always a lot of times down by the dock, you know, by the boat on the dock, and it was a floating dock. And I remember one night, it was kind of evening time in the springtime, and the sun was setting, but it wasn't dark yet. And I saw these worms like swimming around in the water. I was like, holy cow, look at those worms. They're kind of like swimming centipedes, sort of. And the guys were like, oh, yeah, you just wait the next few days and see what happens. I go, well, what's going to happen? They go, well, and this is what happened. They go, the herring are going to come in and feed on those little worms. And I was like, oh, and they go, yeah, and then we're going to net a bunch of those herring. I was like, okay, that sounds fun. And they go, and then the salmon are going to come in and feed on those herring. And I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds cool. And they go, and then the sea lions are going to come in and feed on those salmon. I was like, oh, my God, man, that's going to be crazy. You mean right here in this little harbor? And they go, yep, right here. And they go, and then the killer whales are going to come in and feed on the seals and sea lions. And I was like, are you kidding me? And they go, nope, they'll be right here in the bay. And you know what? That is exactly what happened. And you just got to watch that whole cycle of life occur right there in that bay, like day after day. And then tons of bald eagles up there, too. And the bald eagles would feed on the salmon. And I'm not kidding. It was just a crazy experience being up there in Alaska. Anyway, so I was in Alaska for about a year. Like, I think I went in February of 77. Yeah, I think I went in February of 77. And I got accepted to Class E school in Governor's Island, New York, believe it or not, electrician's mate school. And it was on an island called Government Island, which was literally an island just for the U.S. Coast Guard. So when you got to the big city of New York, you would take a ferry that was a Coast Guard ferry to Government Island, and the schools were there. There were a few schools there. And did I say Class E? I think I meant Class C school. Anyway, it was so long ago, I don't remember. But anyway, so think of this. So I was a 19-year-old redneck from Springfield, Oregon, little logging town. Went in the Coast Guard, went to Juneau, Alaska, and then immediately to New York City. And I mean like Manhattan part of New York City. Because I know the Staten Island Ferry used to pull in kind of close to where the Coast Guard ferry pulled in, because they told you don't get on the wrong ferry, like you might not survive. I don't know. But man, New York City was an eye-opener from a redneck from, you know, Oregon. Crazy time. But the funny thing was, I wanted to experience it. Like, after I got on the, got on the island, got checked in, got my room, you know, met my roommate. You know, I think we had a couple days, maybe the weekend, to settle in. And then the first week of class, of course, because it is very regulated. You know, you go to class at 8. You get done at 5 or 4. I don't know. It seemed long, though. And you get lunch, of course. But it was very regimented, of course, because it's a service. And, man, we were immediately thinking, like, okay, when are we going to the city? Like, we got to go see this. And, I mean, there was guys in that class from all over the country. So there were probably guys, you know, who knew New York, or, you know, they were from bigger cities like, Chicago or Detroit, or, you know, like L.A. or, you know, there was just guys who were used to big cities, and there was a bunch of us boneheads who weren't used to anything like that. I mean, so they would tell you, they kind of gave you a little course on how to behave when you were in the city, you know, like don't pick up any hookers and don't take those flyers from anybody. And, you know, don't stand in the middle of the street staring up at the buildings, which, I mean, honest to God, how could you not go from the country, anywhere in the country, like country boy, go to New York City and not stand on a street corner and just stare up 100 floors at buildings? I mean, it was insane. But I really wanted to kind of try out all of this stuff. Well, not all of the stuff. I wanted to go to, you know, like 42nd Street. I wanted to go to Times Square. I wanted to just walk the streets and see what New York people were like. I wanted to eat the food. I'm telling you, like, one of the greatest, well, there's two great experiences I had in New York City that I hope everybody would share this same experience if you haven't been to New York City and you ever plan to go, which I know it sucks. I know it's a horrible city, but I'm telling you, there's some things that you just got to experience. One is you got to have a piece of street pizza in New York City. I'm serious. It's probably not the best pizza in the world, but it's the experience. I mean, it's certainly not crappy pizza. Of course, it kind of depends on what kind of pizza you like. But there's something about, like, being on the streets in New York City, I don't care, daytime or evening, whatever, or in that, you know, period between daytime and evening, and just getting a piece of fresh, hot pizza off one of those street carts, I'm telling you, is unbelievable experience. And then the other thing was the world's greatest cup of coffee, which it isn't. In fact, I thought it was horrible. But I look back on it fondly now because whenever I watch Elf, I swear to God that's the coffee shop I was in. Although he might not have been in New York City, like for real. But it looked like the same kind of coffee shop. And he walks in and he goes, "Congratulations, you did it," because it says world's best cup of coffee. And I remember when I got to New York City, it was one of the first things I wanted to try. I was like, oh, I got to try world's best cup of coffee. And then when I drank it, I was like, ugh, this is horrible. But it's just a fond memory. And I'm sure there's kind of some of that nostalgia attached to eating street pizza in New York City too, but I seem to remember that it was just like so good. And maybe it is because it was probably really cold, because I got there in February, so you figure February, March, April was times I've spent most of my time or my free time going to the city. And you know, anything hot would be really delicious. So anyway, yeah, there's some nostalgia attached to that, I'm sure, but I'm also sure it was pretty damn good pizza. You know, and probably not my favorite. Like, I don't look for places that advertise New York pizza. Like, it's not a thing for me. It's not like, oh, I got to have some New York pizza. Nope, only if you're in New York. Seriously, I think that's where you get New York pizza. Anyway, that was fun. I'll tell you another story, and I think I've mentioned this before on my show, and I don't know why I would have, but I think I did. So, you know, I was dressed up pretty nice. I was alone, which is weird because we almost never went to the city alone. But I was walking down the street, and I saw this chick ahead of me, and she had really long hair, like to the middle of her back. And it was green, like part of it was green. And I was like, wow, that's really crazy. I got to go see this. So I'm kind of, you know, I don't want to, I mean, there's a bajillion people. So it wasn't like, you know, I bet New Yorkers don't really think somebody's ever following them because you're 100% of the time being followed by a bajillion other people. Oh, break time. I'll be right back. All right, thanks for that little break. I won't forget where I was, maybe. Hey, but I did want to say there's going to be a show on Sundays. I don't know the name of it. Sorry, Rob. Anyway, there's going to be a show on Sundays. It's a music show. If you want to make a request to the show, you can do that in the chat room, and it'll be included in the list. And just come to Real Liberty Media on Sunday. Between 12 and 3 Eastern time, and we'll have a live music show, which will be awesome. We had a little taste of it last week. It was fantastic, a lot of fun, and you can chat, or you can go about your life and listen in. It's a good time. Okay, so this green-haired lady was in front of me walking down the street, and I just had to see it because, you know, you know even back in the 70s, you were like, okay, you know, I hear New York is crazy and there's a lot of wacky stuff going on there. I had to go see this lady with green hair. So I'm trying to walk a little faster, you know, and kind of keep an eye on her. And I kind of catch up to her, and I was within a few feet, like like within 6 feet. And I am looking like, what is that? And I get a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And I notice it's bugs, like it was like mold or mildew or something. And it was crawling with bugs. Oh, I was so disappointed. But I sort of had to laugh about my own naivete, I guess. And it was kind of funny just thinking, what the heck was that? And then finding out what it was, and it was absolutely nothing that I thought it was going to be. Too bad. It was kind of sad. Okay, so what was I talking about? Okay, my Forrest Gump life. Okay, so I became an electrician. I went from electrician school to a Coast Guard cutter in Port Angeles, Washington, which was kind of like more my style, sort of like a country boy. It's a little bit redneck out there in the northwest corner of Washington. Port Angeles, Washington. It's kind of just south of Vancouver, Canada. I think you can take a ferry straight across. Maybe you can't there. Maybe it's the next, I don't know, somewhere around there you can take a ferry to Vancouver. And anyway, I was there for like a year, and I got promoted, of course. When I got out of electrician school, I got promoted. And then I was on the Coast Guard cutter, the 327-foot cutter, for about a year. And I got promoted again, which kind of blew everybody away, like especially a couple of electricians who'd been there for a couple years, and they didn't get promoted. And then I got transferred to another smaller ship in Seattle, Washington, and it had a small crew too. It was like 8 guys on that ship, and it pushed a barge. So it was a 65 foot buoy tender with a 60 foot barge cabled to the front of it. So we were 125 feet overall length. And the funny thing about that ship was, well, number one, it was a very small crew, which will lead me into why I became a dentist in just a minute. But the funny thing about that boat was that the captain or boatswain's mate never stayed out at night. He never anchored, like, period. It was kind of his rule that he would be in somewhere at night. So he would just, like, he would call up yacht clubs or whatever and be like, yeah, we're going to be pulling in and tying up at your dock, blah, blah, blah. And we would just, like, pull in wherever. And usually we didn't stay out that many nights either. It would be like, I don't know, 1 or 2 nights out overnight, maybe a week at the most. But we would pull in somewhere every night. So even though we were away from home port, we were literally somewhere, like, and only in the Puget Sound too. Like, we never went out in the real ocean. I know Puget Sound is salt water and stuff, but what I'm saying is, like, no, we didn't go out in the ocean. Like, we had to stay in water that we could, like, walk to shore on, basically. That's kind of a joke between the Navy and Coast Guard, by the way. So anyway, that was cool, and I was on that boat when I got discharged from the U.S. Coast Guard, an honorable discharge in 1980. And, okay, so here's another kind of crazy Forrest Gump story. So when I was on that boat, as the electrician, I mean, we had to all do all the jobs because there's only 8 people. So you couldn't have, like, just the deckhands, like, pouring concrete, for example, or building navigational aids. Everybody had to do it. So only the guy running the ship, actually steering the ship, he was the only one who didn't have to do anything other than steer the ship. Everybody else had to cook and clean and, you know, build foundations to put navigational aids on and to service navigational aids, which was my job as the electrician. I had to go in and change the power boxes and stuff. Okay, so here's the deal. So navigational aids at the time in the Puget Sound had this contraption attached to them that cost like $6,000. So in case they were hit by lightning, it really didn't even protect them. But supposedly it would protect them. Well, I looked at that whole system. I was like, man, this is so stupid. Why don't you just put a $50 Radio Shack power supply on this thing? And if it gets hit by lightning, you just replace the power supply. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. you know, $50 versus $6,000. So I actually submitted this whole idea to the U.S. Coast Guard, like, hey, we ought to replace all of this expensive crap with a $50 Radio Shack or whatever other cheap power supply. Well, I actually got credited with saving the Coast Guard a ton of money, and I was supposed to stay in the Coast Guard until November of 84, but college started in September, so I wrote this letter saying that I'd like to be released early so I could start college, even though I hadn't actually served out my full 4 years of active duty. It would be like 2 months short. And they actually gave it to me because I had saved them all this money on this other stupid thing. It was pretty crazy, right? But, I mean, what I'm trying to tell you is, like, this crazy life I've lived, like, every step of the way there's been something, like, strange. Like, you know, my dental career, so I'm going to tell you, when I was on that 65-foot buoy tender with a 60-foot barge attached to it, we'd go up in the San Juan Islands. We'd go all over the Puget Sound, but I just remember this one particular day. I was up in the San Juan Islands. It was pouring rain, Pacific Northwest drencher, and it was cold. And, you know, we had, you know, you have like, you know, government-issued rain gear and government-issued clothes and government-issued dockers and government-issued hat. And what we were doing is we were pouring concrete on a rock so we could build a navigational aid so people wouldn't run into it. And like I said, there's only like eight of us on the boat, and one was driving, so the other seven of us, you know, had to haul concrete, basically, and build this foundation, build a platform, and, you know, and then you have to build the navigational aid on top of it, and then you have to put batteries in it, and you have to put this power supply. Well, that one didn't have a power supply. It was only batteries. And, yeah, so it's just soaking wet. It's brutally hard work, like, you know, pouring concrete. I'm not talking about, like, putting it in a mixer and pumping it over to the island. We literally push the barge up next to the rock and mix the concrete, because the concrete mixer, of course, is fixed, because you can't have stuff like that flying around on the boat when you're going through rough waters. And you would, you know, pour the concrete in like wheelbarrow it out there and then shovel it in. Oh, my God. I'm telling you, it was hard work and it was miserable. And I was just thinking that day, I was like, man, someday I'm just going to have a job where I'm just indoors, out of the elements, like in a controlled environment, and it'd be nice and clean and, you know, quiet. And I wouldn't say that that's the day I decided to be a dentist, but that's the day I started looking at the kind of jobs that you could do to be in a, you know, to be like in a, you know, in a more environmentally controlled space, which, you know, I've been pretty happy with it so far. But so I see we're getting down to 10 minutes, and I wanted to get to this point today. Man, my voice, I don't know. I wanted to get to this point today. Well, one, I was going to tell you a lot more, which maybe on Wednesdays we'll kind of keep this sort of informal, you know, tell some kind of goofy stories about life in general or maybe somebody else's life or whatever. But, so in the past week, I was approached by another doctor in this group, and she is a specialist. She's a pediatric dentist, so she works on kids. And I've worked with her before. About 4 years ago, I worked with her for a few months in a different office, same company, but a different office. And so she had been sending me these emails asking if I could do, okay, let me tell you this. And I was going to kind of get through all of this, but I didn't. So when I became a dentist and I went in the public health service, one thing about public health service is they don't have like a ton of specialists at every assigned area you can be assigned to. As a matter of fact, you're pretty much the only resource. So you don't have some oral surgeon that you can send difficult extractions to. You don't have an endodontist that you can send root canals to. You don't have an orthodontist that you can send kids to that need their teeth straightened. You don't have a periodontist that you can send people to for periodontal surgeries or maintenance or whatever. So you end up being the person that has to provide that wide range of services, which in my case has been kind of awesome because in the places I was assigned to, they were remote enough that if I didn't do it, there was nobody else going to do it. Whatever it was, if it was a root canal, if it was a difficult extraction, if it was fixing fractured mandible or setting it temporarily until they could get to somebody. So I had this kind of awesome progression through my career in those early years from 89 to 2005, where, or 88. I think, yeah, 88 to 2005, where I just learned everything, like how to do everything in dentistry. And some things I took a liking to and am very good at, and some things, you know, I could live without doing those things. And so a couple things that I would say I'm really good at are extractions, even difficult ones, even impacted third molars or whatever, teeth that are close to the sinus, whatever, just complex extractions because I had to do so many. And then the other thing was doing root canals. Now, why I became good at root canals, I'll never know because when I was in dental school, I thought it was like the biggest waste of time. I absolutely hated it. But as my career progressed, technology got much better for doing root canals, much faster and much cleaner. And yeah, I know there's a whole argument out there about, you know, root canals are never sterile. And that's probably true. I would say, yeah, that's probably true. But if you have a root canal that lasts 20 or 30 years, I'd say that's pretty successful. I actually even consider them successful if they last 5 years. So anyway, I get this email. I've been getting these emails from this pediatric dentist for a few weeks. And she would attach the patient's name, and yeah, our email's all secure and encrypted, so, you know, it's all legal HIPAA stuff, and it's in our office, you know, whatever. So she sends me a bunch of, you know, referrals, and these are kids. Now, one of the things that I don't care to do is kids, period. I'm just not interested, and it's not because of the kids. Kids are usually great. But parents are horrible. Parents suck. They're terrible. So I don't like working on kids. But this pediatric dentist is not, I won't say it. She's not anything. She asked me if I would do root canals on like 12-year-olds if they were put to sleep, which sounds awesome to me. It's very dangerous to be put to sleep, okay? But if I'm going to work on kids, they need something, some kind of sedation that, you know, even when I see some kids that I think, yeah, maybe they could do whatever this is, I'll just ask them, like, hey, straight up, if you come back for me to do that filling, I'm going to have to give you a couple shots to put the tooth to sleep. And, you know, can you do that? And if they, any hesitation at all, they get referred to, you know, a pedodontist or a doc who uses some sedation methods, because I don't like to use sedation methods. What I'm getting to is our entire group doesn't have some people, enough people. Actually, I'll start over. So this pediatric dentist, number one, she does not feel comfortable doing root canals on permanent teeth. And if you're 12 years old, you have 6-year molars and you have 12-year molars, and you might have some premolars and canines in there, and, you know, your anterior. Anyway, there's a lot of permanent teeth. So she knew that I did a lot of root canals, and that, you know, they've all seen, they all have access to the same records I do. You know, this is a big group. It covers a large portion of Oregon, and all those records are available so they can look and see what kind of work I've done. And she came and asked me if I would do these root canals. And they know I don't work on children because I don't like to work on children. But here's the deal. Like, there is such restrictions right now from the people who could normally do these things. So let's say an endodontist, a person who's a specialist at doing root canals. Well, apparently they're not taking 12-year-old kids right now. Like, they're just not accepting 12-year-old kids right now. The pediatric dentist, they are pediatric dentists, so they generally work on primary teeth, the first set of teeth that comes in, not the second set, not the permanent set. And there's not a lot of people in the entire group of dentists in this company that I guess are comfortable doing root canals on molars. So I've been tagged to be the person. You know, they asked me if I would do it, and I was like, ooh, I don't know, man. And they have a whole general anesthesiology team that comes in and puts kids to sleep and wakes them up and, you know, provides all the kind of support and everything. And I was like, okay. Well, I really hate that children are not getting the care they need. Because it sucks, man. If they don't get the care they need on these teeth at this time, they're going to lose them. There's only two choices once you get to the stage of needing a root canal on your tooth. It's to either extract the tooth or do a root canal on it and then do a crown on it to preserve it for a long period of time. So if these kids don't get fixed, they're losing their teeth. The bottom line, there's no other choice. So here I am again. And of course, you know, I'm going to do whatever I can do to help out. Because it does bother me, man. And even though as little as I like working on kids, I still feel pretty lousy that somehow they're getting cut out of the treatment regimen here. They're getting kind of cut out of the, you know, for whatever reasons, and I'm not sure what they are. I'm honestly not sure what they are. Like, why would you say in your practice, I'm not going to see 12-year-old kids for root canals? I don't understand that. Especially if you're a specialist. I mean, you get paid a lot of money for doing root canals if you're a specialist. I mean, I get paid a lot of money for doing root canals, and I'm not a specialist. But if I send you to a specialist, you're going to pay even more money. And I see I'm out of time. Hey, thanks for putting up with this stuff today. I just thought maybe it would be fun to hear a little bit about my life, and I kind of got to the point I wanted to get at. Let's see, you guys have a great week. I'll see you on Saturday, if nothing else. Remember, if you have requests, song requests, to put them into Real Liberty Media chat. and catch that show. And I don't think I saw the name of it. Anyway, just come to Real Liberty Media. Listen live Sundays, 12 to 3 Eastern time. And we'll see you there. Oh, yeah, and catch me on Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern. Thanks. Bye.